I'm William Shutkin.
And I'm Andy Bush.
Welcome to the Sustainable City Show, a new podcast where we discuss bold ideas and innovations for green, equitable, and climate-friendly cities with the people making them happen. Law and urban planning professor and advocate Sarah Bronin founded Desegregate Connecticut to transform Connecticut's zoning laws from tools for racial exclusion to instruments of social change and sustainability. Widely viewed as the poster child of the suburban state, whose old industrial cities and communities of color have suffered decades of neglect and disinvestment, Connecticut is wising up. Bronin thinks her state can teach the rest of us something useful, even visionary, about how to build sustainable, equitable communities through land use and zoning reform. Sarah Bronin is the Mexican-American architect and attorney whose interdisciplinary research focuses on how law and policy can foster more equitable, sustainable, well-designed, and connected places. As a leading voice on historic preservation law and related land use practices, Bronin was recently nominated by the Biden administration to chair the U.S. Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. In addition to her books and treatises on land use and historic preservation law, Bronin has written over 24 articles on renewable energy, climate change, housing, urban planning, transportation, real estate development, and federalism. Her forthcoming book, Key to the City, will explore how zoning rules rule our lives. Through the Legal Constructs Lab, she created the National Zoning Atlas to translate and standardize tens of thousands of zoning codes across the country. She has advised the National Trust for Historic Preservation and Sustainable Development Code, has served on the board of Latinos in Heritage Conservation, and founded Desegregate Connecticut. Previously, she led the award-winning, unanimously adopted overhaul of the zoning code and city plan of Hartford, Connecticut. Bronin holds a JD from Yale Law School, a Master of Science from the University of Oxford, where she was a Rhodes Scholar, as well as a Bachelor of Architecture and BA from the University of Texas, Austin. Welcome, Sarah.
Great, Sarah. Thank you for being here today. It's interesting. When I think of zoning codes, they were initially meant to keep us safe and to protect health. And now they become such a lightning rod as we look at then potentially as a divisive point for diversity and inclusion. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got interested in this area, and really how it's starting to play out as you look at zoning today. Give us the big picture.
So zoning is the local regulation of land uses, structures, and lots. It is a basic regulatory tool that orders our economy and our society, but it's not very well understood. I grew up in Houston, which happens to be the only large American city without zoning. The consequence of that has been that Houston is typified by sprawl, which is low density, large lot development that is typically environmentally destructive and doesn't really lead to good quality of place. And so thinking about the potential of zoning to help to order a city in a better way was certainly something on my mind, even when I was younger and driving an hour to get between my house and piano lessons, and even at one point an hour to get between my house and school. So I would say that experience turned me on to trying to understand what the consequences of local land use laws were. And so I pursued that line of inquiry, both as an undergraduate architecture student at the University of Texas and then through my master's degree in law school.
Given those roots in Texas and in a zoning-free city called Houston, how did you come to focus not just on zoning, but the inclusionary or equity side of the zoning equation? And in particular, how did you come to found Desegregate Connecticut? What's the story behind that effort?
Well, you know, many scholars have written about the role of zoning in creating or reinforcing segregation between people of different races and ethnicities, or even different income levels. We have seen historically over time that as zoning has become more restrictive, it creates these rifts, and again, in a way that people have not fully studied or appreciated. In 2020, in the summer, shortly after George Floyd's murder, of course, many people across the country were thinking about inequity and the different ways that we embed systemic racism in our laws and in our systems. And it occurred to me, like it occurred to many people across the country, that zoning laws were one of those sets of laws and systems that have perpetuated segregation, racism at different points. And that's not to say that, you know, people who administer or write zoning codes are racist now, you know, but the outcomes of these codes certainly are unequal. And so thinking about that from Connecticut, where, as you point out, it's a very suburban state. It is a state with central cities, with suburbs, with rural areas, and with, frankly, some of the most restrictive zoning laws in the country. I thought it might be a good idea to start a conversation here about the role of zoning in creating the systemic inequities that many people across the country were thinking about the summer of 2020. So we started Desegregate Connecticut with a phone call, Zoom call, because of course we were in the midst of the pandemic by that point, and really had just sent out the invitation to any listservs that I'm on. So I'm an architect. I sent it out to the architecture listserv. I'm a lawyer, sent it out to the land use bar, and was on the planning listserv as well. And from that call, I put it out on Twitter. From that call, 280 people joined the first meeting of what would be Desegregate Connecticut, where we acknowledged that our land use laws were a problem and tried to say that we're going to try to figure out how to at least start to address it by education, by advocacy, and by really tackling the issues that many people have discussed. And so that's where Desegregate Connecticut started. And from there, we developed a coalition model where we had up to 80 coalition members and nonprofits, 80 nonprofits, separate nonprofits, including affordable housing groups, environmental groups, the Home Builders Association, the AIA, the American Planning Association, and other unlikely bedfellows in some cases. But we were really proud of the coalition that we built to advance zoning reform, because really the time was past due for Connecticut to tackle that important issue.
Amazing. So in 2+ years, Sarah, you've been able to achieve what at Desegregate Connecticut? What are some of the specific outcomes that you can point to today? And as someone who grew up in suburban Connecticut, the southwestern part of the state, aka Fairfield County, and having experienced that rather profound divide between some of the more sort of gentrified suburbs of the state and some of the grittier cities, whether New Haven or Bridgeport or indeed even Hartford. I can appreciate the challenge that you must have faced. And in 2.5 years, it sounds like you've been able to accomplish decades worth of reform and awareness building. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think that there's a lot more work to do, and probably there always will be. But a year and a day after that first Zoom call that I mentioned, the state did adopt into law the first significant zoning reforms in several decades. And that included updates to the Zoning Enabling Act, which every state has. Every state tells local governments what they can do when it comes to zoning. So updates to that, an allowance for accessory dwelling units, a cap on minimum parking requirements, a training requirement for commissioners, a ban on minimum unit sizes, which localities have used to require very large apartments. 2,000 square feet, we found in some communities, was the minimum wow. unit size for an apartment. And more, and you know, all of that's up on the Desegregate website. But beyond the state legislative reforms, we've seen local governments change their zoning laws in response to the what we hope was increased conversation in the news and in the state house about zoning. So we had local changes happen as well. And we also built what I think is a pretty innovative set of data and information about zoning, which we called the Connecticut Zoning Atlas, mm-hmm. and which informed not just our advocacy, but also a series of written research reports, issue briefs on topics ranging from transit-oriented development to minimum lot sizes, to the environmental case for zoning reform. So that zoning atlas has really unlocked a lot of both advocacy, but also secondary research that illuminates the problems of zoning beyond the equity problem that motivated so many of us to start Desegregate, but expanding into environmental and economic issues as well.
That's amazing, Sarah. And now, Sarah, as I understand it, the Atlas project is a national project. Is that correct?
So the Connecticut Zoning Atlas has become the first completed state of the National Zoning Atlas. And that national project aims to use the methods of the Connecticut Zoning Atlas to translate and standardize information about zoning districts across the country. So we have almost a dozen states to add to who have already signed up for the Atlas, including large states like California and New York, where we have researchers in Berkeley in California and UC Davis, researchers at Cornell in New York, along with Fordham and the University of Buffalo, all working together to compile atlases in those states, along with states like Montana, Hawaii, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and others who have, you know, maybe smaller in population, but still extremely interesting land use practices. And we are, through this National Zoning Atlas project, going to be able to compare how each state is doing, how large cities are doing, how similar regions across the country are doing. And we hope that this, too, will help to unlock secondary research, just like the Connecticut Zoning Atlas has in Connecticut.
I love that. Sarah, do you ultimately see this as something that helps to develop idealized codes or form codes that others can use? Or are you finding that things are just so different and so unique in each place that each community should really understand its place before it goes and adopts a generalized code?
So far, we're seeing that zoning practices around the country tend to be pretty similar. The vast majority of land devoted to large lot, single family housing, and only a very small percent of land is devoted to multifamily housing as of right, or other types of diverse housing like cottage clusters or tiny homes. We're seeing that because of that homogeneity across especially suburban areas, we are seeing that zoning has become a one-size-fits-all approach where you have these practices in cities that have led America to build only one kind of community, a community that relies on cars, a community that is a single-use that creates single-use neighborhoods, so just residential neighborhoods, as opposed to the kinds of neighborhoods that we used to build historically, where you could walk to the corner store or walk to the library or walk to the bank. That is hurting not only our environment, but it is hurting our health because we are driving all the time. Not only does driving emit greenhouse gases and toxic fumes, and we don't walk as much as we should. We don't get out and exercise as much as we should. And we couldn't in a community which has 1 acre minimum zoning. In Connecticut, we found in our atlas that 80% of residential land requires 1 acre zoning. So in other words, if you build a house, you need an acre of land to do that. So now what does that do to our forests, our farmland, our wetlands. It just eats them up, causing this sort of vicious cycle of our creating places that hurt us, and then destroying the natural environment that would help us to respond to the pain caused by creating those places. So that's something that we're seeing in all of the states where we have zoning atlas projects underway. Now, to address your question about what we hope that this information will show or achieve, we aren't looking to create a standardized zoning code from this, but what we're hoping to do is to expose how backwards many of our zoning codes are in the hopes that that might help us rethink the relationship between our zoning laws that constrain almost everything that's built in this country and the future that we want to have.
Well said. Sarah, I'd love for us to circle back, you and me, on Colorado and maybe adding Colorado to your list of other states participating in the Atlas Project. Andy and I on this very podcast, among other fora, have talked a lot about places like Boulder, Colorado, of course, where we are, where about 83% of the city's land is zoned exclusively for single family. Not large lot, not 1 acre size, but still very restrictive. And we're just starting to have the conversation, a serious conversation, about beginning to break up that monoculture of zones to allow for more multifamily, mixed income. And it is happening slowly but surely, not necessarily with the support of our zoning code, though we've made some meaningful reforms. Is there a particular community in your jurisdiction in Connecticut, for example, or for that matter, other parts of the country that you point to or a set of communities as sort of model or exemplary in the way they've used zoning to promote inclusion and environmental sustainability?
Yes, I'm going to make a totally Connecticut-centric pitch here for people to look at the zoning code of Hartford. So I chaired the city's zoning commission for 7 years, and we completely overhauled our very outdated zoning code. We made all housing, including multifamily housing, as of right, meaning that there are no public hearing requirements for public housing. We instituted, we instituted a form-based code, which sets out clear rules for heights and bulks and building forms that enables us to protect the charming historic character of neighborhoods while still allowing a diversity of uses. We rezoned some of the city to enable more mixed-use developments that would encourage walkability. And we have a series of sustainability measures, including requirements for bike parking, eliminations of minimum car parking requirements entirely citywide. And we were the first city to do that citywide.
Wow.
Requirement that if you do have parking, that you have EV charging stations, a certain percentage of the lot, and landscaping requirements, as well as stormwater management requirements that I think are among the most innovative or stringent or however you want to look at it in the country. Because in our city, which has, again, lots of historic neighborhoods, but a downtown that has been paved over with surface parking lots, a city that's an urban city, a low-income city, a city with a high percentage of minority residents. You know, we are the typical post-industrial city, which really neglected tree canopy is a high, you know, we have high urban heat temps in the summer. And we really just needed to use zoning, among other tools, to rethink Hartford's long-term sustainability. So I would say if you are, you know, you're out there, and especially if you come from a mid-sized post-industrial city like Hartford, check out our code. I wrote a paper about it called Comprehensive Rezonings. You can look that up. There's a free download at SSRN, the Social Science Research Network. And it goes through each of these provisions. And I would say, I think altogether, we are turning a corner here and hopefully going to create a much more sustainable city than we've had in the past.
That's a great story. I mean, tell us a little bit more about the form-based code side of it and how that got integrated into the zoning overhaul, and that William and I are both working in an area of Boulder that's really the first form-based code portion of the city, but not the whole city. And we are both pretty excited about that kind of an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that form-based codes can help with is they can create certainty in development outcomes for both current residents and for prospective developers and prospective neighbors. A form-based code can tell you, for example, that the building can be between 2 and 4 stories tall. If you're on, let's say, a commercial or a historic Main Street, you might say that the first floor has to have large storefront windows, so you create a welcoming feel. You can say that the code is the code can lay out a series of uses, which are less relevant when you know what kind of building you're going to get. I mean, ideally, the best building. So my other hat is I'm a historic preservationist, and I study a lot about local historic preservation laws. And you know, the best buildings are durable, and they can go through many different uses over many different years. And that's in zoning for flexibility is something that's really important to the long-term viability of a commercial Main Street or really any community. So a form-based code can give you some certainty about what kinds of buildings you're going to get. It can help to encourage investment because you know that you're what will be approved without having to go through a very arbitrary public hearing process that sometimes you see at the local level with zoning commissions that fluctuate wildly between applications and what they will approve. And they might vote just simply based on what they had for lunch that day. And we see those decisions ending up in court over and over again. A form-based code can help with that. It can also help with sustainability. So it can also say there's a minimum height that you have to build here. We don't want a one-story strip mall, a setback far from the street. We want something close to the street. We want to create a sidewalk. We want you to have street trees this far apart. And we want you to have a 2 or 3 story building so that when people are walking by, they can have a, you know, and feel like, and you have the opportunity for a walkable environment. So it has the potential. Now, if your form-based code requires strip malls, okay, then that's a different story. But most of the form-based codes that are out there take the view that they're supposed to be creating walkable mixed-use communities that are beautiful and functional. And so if you got one of those form-based codes, and if that's what you're developing in, there in Boulder, you're on the right track.
Yeah, we're close, but maybe not quite. And the governance side is key, right? The idea of the form-based code was make it almost self-executing, less time dealing with the arbitrariness of a review process and more time focused on outcomes and standards. Boulder's still trying that out. We've got a very active, as many communities like Boulder do, planning board and city council, who sometimes reaches beyond, let's say, the bounds of their jurisdiction to get into the weeds. But I think we're learning. Sarah, tell us a little bit more about how you were able to build support for such a comprehensive set of reforms in your city. Now, having grown up in and around, or near, I should say, Hartford, you know, for a long time, Hartford was a struggling city, as you noted earlier. Second or third tier, as we might say, looking at U.S. cities over the last half century, having had this illustrious past as an insurance capital, among other things, and then being a city, you know, for some time without much of an identity. I remember in the early days working in Boston, the New England Patriots were thinking of building a football stadium along the Connecticut River, a very exciting proposal being supported among others, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, because the football stadium would have been on the site of a big brownfield. I can't remember exactly what the site was, but I remember everybody getting really excited because maybe this was one of those, you know, catalytic sports stadium projects that would turn the tide for the city. Do you think, given sort of Hartford's desire to now compete and rise up again as a great center, it's got universities, it's got business, it's got great access to everything from airports to mountains, did it make it easier, therefore, to sell such a sort of visionary zoning program versus, say, a Boston, a New York, a Los Angeles, where the land use politics are perhaps all the more controversial and contested? Or is there something else we can take away from your Hartford case that we could apply to any city, be it Boulder or Boston?
I think that the overhaul in Hartford was well supported and in fact was a unanimous vote in one night, the first day that we considered the language. It was because we had a lot of public consultation and explanation about what the zoning code promised if we rewrote it in a way that created more certainty for people living in neighborhoods about what they would see, but also created more opportunity for our entrepreneurs and developers who we know we needed to attract to bring in infill development to these many vacant parking lots and underutilized parcels around the city, as well as repurposing the industrial buildings, including many large factories that had been abandoned for decades because we don't need so many factories to be located here in Hartford anymore. That's not our economy. So we were able to build a case by going very methodically to every neighborhood group, to every chamber of commerce, to environmental organizations around the state, to housing groups, to really anybody who would speak to us about zoning. And even those who didn't know that much about what zoning was or does, we made a very concerted effort. I went to many meetings, small meetings, big meetings, and made the case for reform and explained what zoning, what the zoning code would do. We had also hired a firm called Codemetrics to help with many of the aspects of the code, including that form-based code. So going around the city, looking at each of the building types that existed in the city and showing how the new building types that would be embedded in the code would complement what was already there. So again, when we voted on the zoning code draft, it was a unanimous vote in one night, and we made tweaks to the zoning code about a dozen times while I was still chair after we tossed out the old code and brought in the new one. So we didn't just stop at the overhaul. We saw as different cases and issues arose, how we had maybe left something out or needed a different cross-reference or maybe needed a new use category. And we made those changes along the way. So I think both knowledge about best practices in zoning and a willingness to be flexible, as combined with a public outreach effort that relied a lot on trust, on information, on transparency, helped us to develop the zoning program that we did and to continue it on today. And we don't get complaints in Hartford about zoning. I mean, knock on wood, maybe we will someday. But if we do, we'll fix it, because we know that there's always a chance to improve. So,
Sarah, let me dig a little deeper, because it's such a cool story. So a couple of things, tactically speaking. First, how long did it take you start to finish, you know, initial advocacy to adoption, that one night of unanimous support? What was that period of time? And I think about in Boulder, for example, it took us, what, Andy, about 4 or 5 years to pass ADU, a new ADU ordinance.
Yeah, and accessory dwelling
units. And now we're...
I would say, Sarah...
Go ahead, Ann.
Well, I was just going to say, Sarah, add into kind of the time frame. Tell us a little bit about the interaction with single family neighborhoods and ultimately what the plan did in terms of future change or framework for those neighborhoods. Were they supportive? Were they supportive because they were left alone, or were they supportive of the change that was going to occur over time?
Yeah, and Sarah, just to add to that, sorry, not to confuse, and we can revisit, but what hat were you wearing? Were you wearing Desegregate Connecticut, Planning Commissioner, both? Would love to know sort of how you positioned yourself and your role.
So I became, I started serving on the Planning and Zoning Commission in the city of Hartford in 2013 and became chair a couple months after that. Our zoning code overhaul started in earnest, I would say, in mid-2014. We adopted the complete overhaul in January 2016. So it was a pretty short time period, especially for the tossing completely of the old code. I resigned from the Planning Commission in spring of 2020, thinking that I would devote my time to scholarly research. And that was quickly changed when I promptly started this Desegregate Connecticut statewide movement, which I definitely had not anticipated working on or it becoming as big and complex as it was. So that timeline, so I was chair for about 7 years, and that timeline, again, was unexpected movement. But there was no overlap between my time on the Planning and Zoning Commission in the city and Desegregate Connecticut advocacy. Now, Andy, your question was
support from single family neighborhoods.
Oh yeah.
So pushback or other resistance?
So there were a few things that happened with single family neighborhoods in the new code that we felt created opportunities for single family homeowners. And one of those was the legalization of accessory dwelling units, which were not previously legal in Hartford. And I think, you know, from that, there was some back and forth about that in the discussions with residents of what you would consider to be single family neighborhoods prior to the code change. And, you know, ultimately, again, that part too passed unanimously. Ultimately, I think we were able to convince most that because of the different aspects of the ADU regulations, that they would be very well integrated into our neighborhoods, especially given the fact that we have so many neighborhoods with extremely large houses and carriage houses and what would have been, you know, quote unquote, servants' quarters back in the day that were sitting underutilized in part because restrictive zoning rules didn't enable those to be changed. We also rezoned several larger parcels within single family neighborhoods for multifamily housing, which previously had been restricted from, in some cases, even being housing. So there were different aspects of zoning code that maybe had particular impacts on these neighborhoods. And to be honest, although we had conversations about those issues, when the night of the hearing came, we really didn't have a ton of pushback from the public. I think that we had one person read a letter where multiple people signed saying they might be concerned about this issue or that, but it wasn't the kind of effort that changed anybody's votes. And it was, I think, widely recognized, even in those communities, that some change might be beneficial.
So on that note, let's maybe wind down with Desegregate and sort of where it's going to go from here, what it's doing now, Sarah, where it goes from here. Does the comprehensive zoning reform in Hartford sort of set the stage for a larger statewide set of reforms or reforms in municipalities other than Hartford across the state? Sort of what is the Desegregate strategy going forward after its first, 2.5 years of successful launch?
So Desegregate Connecticut is now run by an executive director full-time and housed at the Regional Plan Association, the 100-year-old state agency that has done planning work in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. And I'm hopeful that the
program will continue to grow and gain more organizational supporters, and we'll be able to continue on with statewide reforms. Because Connecticut has both central cities and suburbs, well, I should say central cities, suburbs, and rural areas, there's not going to be a Hartford-centric approach in all places, of course. But what Hartford has done can be a model for especially housing and housing permitting in communities across the state. And we also see models elsewhere in other states and in other cities across the country. So I think Connecticut can continue to learn from these examples, whether in state or out of state, and Desegregate Connecticut will continue to bring those to light through its programs, through its advocacy, and through its facilitation of a network of like-minded pro-homes advocates across the state.
I like that. That's a great partnership with RPA. My friend and colleague, Baye Wilson, a planner, lawyer, developer, started his career at RPA, and is New Jersey-based. So it's really cool that's a platform now for your work. You know, Sarah, coincidentally, just today in the New York Times, we're recording in August. I don't know if you saw the piece on universities and sort of town-gown relationships, the fact that so many U.S. universities, unlike their European counterparts, are often kind of literally walled off from their host communities. You know, I recall back in the day, Trinity College in Hartford was one of the first to sort of open its gates, literal and figurative, to the surrounding neighborhoods of Hartford. Of course, Yale and New Haven have had a long and contested relationship, but even New Haven now is being celebrated as a very livable and up and coming city. Do you have sort of thoughts or insights about what the future holds for Connecticut's bigger cities like New Haven and Hartford and Bridgeport? Are you bullish on their futures? Are we going to see more and more young people showing up there because of the relative affordability of housing, because of universities and research and entrepreneurs? What's your sense of Connecticut's urban future, given work you've been doing?
Yeah, I think Connecticut cities have a wonderful blend of charm and history, culture, and community. And that is very attractive to people, especially young people, but also older people who may not want to live in the kinds of cookie cutter suburbs that we've sometimes been building here in our state. So I'm very bullish on the future of our cities. We do need some changes beyond zoning, but at the state level to make sure that our cities are getting the opportunities to compete on a level playing field, which is not something that they've always had. And I really do think that there's a lot, that we have a lot going in our central cities, which, by the way, none of them are over 130,000 people or so. So these are not huge metropolises, but they have a lot of potential.
Yeah. But Sarah, thank you for joining us today and sharing your stories of real success in Connecticut and beyond with your zoning reform and the work of Desegregate Connecticut, which now it sounds like has outgrown you and is now a full-fledged organization working with RPA, which is really exciting. So congrats, Sarah, and I hope that you continue to do great work. I'll also note, Sarah, that you're now a professor at Cornell Law School and Planning School, and will no doubt be bringing a lot of your talents and resources to Ithaca. So congratulations.
Thanks. I love being at Cornell. I love doing that kind of interdisciplinary work, and I'm really excited that, you know, through my lab, we're able to continue the National Zoning Atlas project, as well as research on historic preservation and maybe at some point the future of cities. So I'm having a lot of fun right now and really grateful for all of the opportunities.